Hi there. Thanks for supporting the Tennis Worthy podcast, which is brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Patrick McEnroe, the president of the Hall of Fame. And one of the most rewarding parts of my job is when we can celebrate people who have used tennis as a backdrop to remarkable feats of human achievement. And we have one of those in today's podcast, an interview with a man of immense courage who was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2023 as a wheelchair champion and just as a great human being. His name is Rick Draney.
19 years old and pretty much doing what I wanted, how I wanted, and whenever I wanted, to laying in a hospital bed and being told how different life was going to be for me from a physical standpoint and trying to come to terms with that. It was a struggle, to be honest. I guess there was a little bit of a stubbornness in me or a determination in me or a curiosity in me or something was to the point that I thought, I'm not a quitter. And I'm not going to give up after one try, so let's see what we can figure out and give it a little time, make a little effort, and let's see what happens with it all. What I hope is that every individual recognizes that the potential is there. It requires some effort, and it requires a change of attitude in some respects. I often tell people, it really isn't about what happens to you or what has happened to you. It's how you choose to deal with it.
Rick Draney had an able-bodied childhood, but life changed when he was involved in a car crash at age 19 and ended up in a wheelchair. Chris Bowers caught up with Rick during the 2024 induction ceremony in Newport, Rhode Island, where the Hall of Fame has its headquarters. And this is more than just a tennis interview. It shows how tennis can help people become the best version of themselves. Take it away, Chris.
Rick, congratulations on becoming a Hall of Famer. What do you think it is that makes someone a Hall of Famer?
Well, thank you, first of all. And I still scratch my head a little bit. I still am in a bit of a state of disbelief that I am actually in the International Tennis Hall of Fame. And, you know, the generic answer is you're either in there as an athlete or a contributor, but it is the sum total of whatever your career has been in tennis, and in my case as an athlete, a wheelchair tennis athlete, the accomplishments that I was able to experience and sustain for a number of years. And so it wasn't just a one and done, so to speak, but over the breadth of my career, there was enough in the way of accomplishments that elevated me to the level to be worthy to be considered to be in the Hall of Fame.
Obviously, there is a point at which your life changed. You had a car accident at the age of 19. Up to 19, what was your sporting background?
I played a lot of sports because I enjoyed being active. I didn't excel in anyone particularly, and I wasn't passionate about anyone in particular. I just enjoyed being active and trying things. Played a lot of basketball, played a lot of baseball, rode motorcycles quite a bit. So those were probably the top three favorites.
Was there any sign of your competitiveness or your smartness on a court, whether that court is a basketball court, a tennis court, a baseball pitch or whatever?
I don't know that I ever thought much about that, the mental side of any game. As I said, I was just enjoying playing. If it was running up and down the court, if it was running around the baseball field, if it was on a motorcycle and going through the countryside kind of thing, over the hills and jumps and around the berms and those types of things, I just enjoyed doing what I did. But again, it was all just fun to me. And even once I finally started wheelchair tennis, I just enjoyed chasing a tennis ball and being outdoors and just the thrill of it and liked the competition. I wanted to win, but I was just there because I really enjoyed playing tennis.
Were you around people as a kid who were destined for the top or at least were attempting to get to the top?
There were some students in high school that I was friends with that they were on, you know, a football team or a basketball team, and they went on to at least collegiate careers, and a couple of them made it into professional sports. But again, the friendship and the association for me was not to that level. I didn't play organized high school sports, and so there was not that training and that regimen and the teaching of the discipline and the focus and the mental side of the game and those types of things. So a lot of that didn't come to me until after I got injured and started wheelchair tennis first and then engaged in the process through wheelchair tennis first, as I said, and then wheelchair rugby second, those two sports and the coaching and the background and the experience I got there, as I decided this is something I want to take more seriously, that's when that process really began for me. So it was basically all new after 19.
So you had the accident, car crash, but that was in 1981, and you've picked up your first tennis racket in 1984 as a wheelchair tennis player. In those 3 years, what was the process for you, obviously recovering physically, but in terms of you having to build a new life for yourself and reframe the world?
And that's really where it started for me. I mean, 19 years old and pretty much doing what I wanted, how I wanted, and whenever I wanted, to laying in a hospital bed and being told how different life was going to be for me from a physical standpoint and trying to come to terms with that and grasp that reality and then begin the rehabilitative process and start learning what you can do, what still is going to be a challenge, how do I adjust, how do I adapt, what can my body help me do, and what do I maybe have to figure out along the way that isn't there now, but maybe at some point in time will come. So those 3 years, it was a struggle, to be honest. I mean, I laying in a hospital bed, just wondered what was possible at some point in time. And so I started going back to college. I was in some college classes before, and I thought, well, I don't know what else to do at this point in time. Got discharged from rehab and thought, well, I'll go back to school, get an education, and at least I'll have something to fall back on as I continue to work on figuring this out. That was early on, 81 and into 82. And then in 82, there was a class that I was in. Another guy in a wheelchair was in there, and we said hello and visited a little bit. And he asked me, you know, well, do you play any sports? And I said, no. And he said, well, there's a wheelchair tennis class and a wheelchair basketball class at Saddleback College if you're interested. And at the time, I remember thinking in my mind, how can I even think about playing tennis or a sport? I'm still trying to figure out how to get through day-to-day life. How do I get from point A to point B? How do I get ready in the morning? How do I get shut down in the evening, kind of thing? Just all of the basic things that I had to get through in a day that I just kind of dismissed it, even though I told him, well, yeah, thanks for telling me. I might have to try that someday. And so we would see each other and visit around campus, kind of thing. And in 83, I was to the point past my rehab. They teach you a certain amount in rehab, but to me, you learn a lot more once you get discharged, because then the world is not flat anymore and the doors don't open automatically and there's not always somebody nearby that can grab this or do that for you if you need help, or they see that, yeah, something's a little bit of a challenge for you. So getting out into the real world began the real rehab process. But as I did that, I was never like depressed about it or truly sad about it. I struggled with coming to terms with it at times and a little frustrated and, you know, why did this happen and what's life going to be like? So there were a lot of unanswered questions and still uncertainties about what the future was going to hold. But as I slowly regained more independence and a better level of mobility, back in my day still, when you got discharged from a hospital, it was basically in a standard hospital type wheelchair. So heavy, 40 pounds, and just all of that. And you can't move as well in one of those, obviously, as you can the new lighter weight chairs that we use now.
I take it you had to develop your arm muscles just to be able to propel yourself.
And that was the thing. I mean, very early on, the neurosurgeon came in after the procedure to stabilize my neck and said, you know, here's what's happened and here's your harsh reality, kind of thing. He just kind of laid it out matter-of-factly, and he said, there's a possibility that you may be in a power chair for the rest of your life. And I thought, okay, have to process that. But I was fortunate that I did start regaining some strength in my upper extremities to the point that I could use a manual chair. And as I used that manual chair and struggled with the heavy weight of that, that probably did increase the strength in my upper arms and got me to the point that I became more mobile, to the point that I started thinking about, and as I mentioned before, it's like, you know, I don't know what's going to be possible anymore, to start thinking about what might be possible. And I went back to thinking about wheelchair tennis and thought, maybe I could do this. Maybe I could try this. And
how far was Saddleback from where you were living?
15 minutes, 15, 20 minutes. So it was nearby. Southern California back in the day was the center of the universe for wheelchair tennis. That's where the National Foundation of Wheelchair Tennis started with Brad Parks and his wife Wendy and the team way back in the day. So there were a lot of individuals in Southern California that were in wheelchair tennis programs, and Saddleback College had one of them, the one that was the closest. So I started entertaining the idea of maybe I'll take Dan up on the invitation to go out and check it out. But I still wasn't self-confident enough to feel like I'm just going to show up. I thought, all right, as a quadriplegic, I don't have the strength to hold a racket in my hands. So I at least want to try to see if I can figure out how to do that first. What can I do so that when I go there, I then maybe hopefully am to the point that, all right, I can just start mobility drills and tennis drills with everybody else.
Because at the time, you talk about wheelchair tennis being well established in Southern California, but quad tennis didn't really exist, did it?
There were a few quad players that did play, and there was always a quad division from the beginnings of the NFWT. However, there weren't a lot of them, and there were a few different methods that some of them used. Some of their injuries or disabilities were such that they actually could hold a racket, but they still had enough impairment in other muscle groups in their upper extremities that they obviously weren't as fast as a paraplegic, and so they were classified in as quadriplegics. Others, Greg Thompson, who was one of the early guys that really set the first standard, and he was the guy to try to beat back in the day, he used a molded orthotic grip that was custom made to your hand that attached to the racket handle, and then you slid your hand inside of the orthotic, and it had some Velcro straps to secure it. And then, you know, I thought about, all right, well, what about just an ACE bandage and athletic tape? I mean, because again, I was so early, I didn't know them yet. I hadn't been introduced to them yet. I wasn't aware yet of what they were doing. So I called a friend. I said, will you take me to a tennis court? I'm going to get an ACE bandage and a roll of athletic tape. And I just want to see if this is even possible, if this is even realistic. So he was kind enough to take me out there. And we're both, all right, we'll try this. And, you know, I was needing a lot of help trying to figure out, all right, well, if you wrap it here and pull it tighter there and adjust those types of things, all right, that feels fairly secure. So you go on the other side of the net and you hit me some balls. And so he hit a ball and it was, you know, not very far from me, but it wasn't where I could reach it. And he hit another one. I still couldn't reach it because I still was struggling with moving. I just used the ACE bandage. And so that hand rim, I didn't have good contact to be able to push well with that hand rim on that side. The ACE bandage was kind of
so split. You saw the ball coming, it was within your reach, but actually it was getting the wheelchair to a position where you could hit it. So holding the racket didn't actually play
not yet.
That was bypassed at that stage.
Yeah, I it's like, all right, number one, I got to get the racket in my hand. Now I got to figure out how to move. And so as I started trying to push, that ACE bandage would slip against the hand rim, and I felt like I was going nowhere.
So you did all this before you went to try wheelchair tennis at Saddleback.
And again, it's not that it would have been an embarrassment, but it's like, well, I don't want to embarrass myself, and I don't want them to have to spend so much time focusing on me when there's a bunch of other players there. It was just like,
and you just spent 3 years trying to get your life back in order.
Yeah, yeah.
So not wanting to be embarrassed in front of a group of people is entirely reasonable.
Yeah. At least it seemed to me at the time. And yet in hindsight, I kind of wish, you know, I wish I just would have had the courage to go do it sooner kind of thing, because it just would have extended the career at that side of things. And I would have started learning and growing just that much faster. But I just wanted to try it, to experiment, to see, do I even want to go try to do this? And so I said, all right, I could move a little bit. He started tossing some balls to me, and I could hit the ball, but we didn't have the ACE bandage tight enough to where it was secure in my hand. And so I said, all right, I let's just go. I'm done with this for now. Maybe I'll just go ahead and go to the class, and maybe they have some information.
Did the racket fly out of your hand?
It did not fly out of my hand, but if I didn't hit it center string, then it would twist a little bit. So then I would kind of twist it again. But all right, I have at least figured out that it looks like this is possible. So now I need to take the next step and get some help from somebody that might know more than I do.
So when you went to Saddleback, was that with Dan or did you go by yourself?
I went by myself. so again, now I'm to the point that I can drive and, you know, I'm doing pretty well day to day and those types of things. Mobility's better. I had finally gotten a lighter weight wheelchair, so I was moving better and felt a little more comfortable in that. So I thought, all right, I'm ready to go try this. Dan was there, as was another guy, Mike Watson, who was a dear friend of mine for many, many years. He really was the one that came up to me and just welcomed me. And, you know, here you go from kind of thinking you're the only one in the world in a wheelchair and dealing with what you're dealing with. And you show up to this class and here's a bunch of guys and girls doing what is just normal for them. And it was like, oh, this is kind of cool. And it was, all right, so I can see what he did. I can see what he did. There weren't any other quadriplegics there. But Ron Hastings, who was the coach of the program, was also director of the Disabled Student Services there. And so he had a little bit of experience. And so he said, all right, well, let's see what we can figure out. And so he started helping me a little bit. Well, let's try this and let's try this and let's try this. And that helped a little bit. It got a little more comfortable and a little bit more secure. And again, with the newer chair that would move a little bit better, I was able to, all right, you know, I'm a first timer. That's okay. I'm doing all right. They got me in the drills and all right, let's bring you up and let's hit a forehand and let's have you turn and try a backhand. And you just begin the whole process. But that's when I really became, I guess, a student in observing what other people were doing, because it was like, all right, all these last 3 years, I've been trying to figure things out on my own. Now I've got a whole bunch of people that I can watch and see, oh, they did that, they did that. That's how they transferred. That's how they hit their forehand. That's how they hit their backhand. Because, again, I played tennis a handful of times before my—
I was going to say, had you played much?
So this was all brand new. I didn't know what it meant to, you know, as far as the terminology in tennis even kind of thing. But
so you were effectively a beginner.
I really was a beginner in a lot of ways at that time, but being around them, watching them, observing them, learning from them, and being involved in that class was a huge lift for me. And that's when the conversations then led me to them telling me that, yeah, there's this quad that lives here. His name's Greg Thompson. There's this quad that lives here. His name is Joel Bernal and some of these other guys in the early, early years that were already playing some. And so then the connections and associations started and trying to understand, well, what does he use? What does he use? How does he do it?
When you were trying to get your life back together again after the crash, there must have been a constant battle between the I'm feeling sorry for myself and I'm not going to let this get me down. Did finding wheelchair tennis allow you to go on the side of I'm not going to let this get me down more than feeling sorry for yourself?
And it really was, again, as I mentioned, that first time I went out with my friend on the court, I almost gave up right then. I thought this isn't feasible, or at least not now. But I guess there was a little bit of a stubbornness in me, or a determination in me, or a curiosity in me, or something was to the point that I thought, I'm not a quitter and I'm not going to give up after one try. So let's see what we can figure out and give it a little time. Make a little effort and let's see what happens with it all. And tennis really was the catalyst that helped finish that transition, because I was, again, I was going to school. I was trying to live life. And yes, I still had a lot of questions and a lot of struggles and there was a lot of uncertainty, but I'm certainly not unique in that. And as you mentioned early on, in all aspects of life, everybody has challenges and difficulties and trials, and they all have to face them, whatever they are for them, in their own way and figure out how they're going to deal with them and move forward. But it's possible. And I was grateful that I finally got to the point that I recognized that and truly believed that for myself. And a lot of it really was because of sports and recreation, and tennis was the first sport.
How long did it take you to feel accepted in the wheelchair tennis community at Saddleback?
It was right away for them. I mean, Ron and Mike and just everybody was incredibly kind and friendly and helpful and patient and all of those things early on. And it made you feel comfortable, and it made you feel like you weren't inhibiting their practice or their workout or those types of things. They were all there to encourage and support. And hey, you know, what can I do for you? Or, you know, here's what I do. I started asking a lot of questions and they had answers for me. And so that made it even that much better that it was an environment where you were welcomed in. And I so much appreciate Ron and everybody at Saddleback College in that program.
Because what I'm slightly aiming at here is, before we get to talk about your achievements that make you a Hall of Famer, let's not put you on a pedestal for a second and say, right, anybody listening to this who has lost their mobility to whatever extent, who is looking for a purpose in life, what can you tell them about what wheelchair tennis can do for somebody whose life's been turned upside down?
What I hope is that every individual recognizes that the potential is there. It requires some effort, and it requires a change of attitude in some respects. I often tell people, it really isn't about what happens to you or what has happened to you. It's how you choose to deal with it that's going to impact the future and your life, kind of thing. There are people that struggled more than I did for longer than I did. There are others that made the transition just that much quicker. For them, it was like, okay, this is my new life. I'm ready to move on, and here I go, kind of thing. So maybe I was somewhere in the middle. I don't know. And there's no, you know, it's like raising a child. There's no textbook to tell you how to deal with an injury or something that happens, something traumatic in your life. Family and friends, the love and support of them were huge for me in supporting me and encouraging me and helped me getting through those initial years and kind of coming to terms with things. There is a level of self-determination and self-decision that everybody has to make, and there's no one way to do that and no certain timeline or time frame in which to do that. But ultimately, it's your choice. In from my perspective, it's the choice of each individual as to how their life is going to be going forward. For me, as much as I like to move and be active before I was injured, that's the part that I struggled with the most. Once I got introduced to tennis and thought, I can feel my muscles be tired and sore again. I can be outdoors and sweat a little bit again. I can be in the sunshine. I can move. That was the thing that for me said, okay, I went from not knowing what was going to be possible to now starting to think about what might be possible going forward and being willing to explore that. And so for me, it was tennis. For others, it's wheelchair rugby or wheelchair basketball or snow skiing or kayaking or water skiing or hand cycling. I mean, that's the other amazing thing about this day and age is there is so many opportunities. There are so many opportunities. The adaptive equipment is so incredible these days that it enhances whatever you do as a sport or recreational pursuit. But the idea is, be willing to give it a try. I was willing to go try it. I wasn't sure. I didn't know yet if I believed in myself, but I was at least ready to be willing to try. And that's what I hope people find in themselves, whatever they're facing, is that let's make an effort. Let's take it one day at a time and let's see where this goes.
When one looks back at your quad wheelchair tennis career, it's almost in two strands. There's the personal with you as a player, and there's also the promotional, the campaigning, because quad tennis wasn't really recognized as a legitimate sport. You know, Paralympics comes from paraplegic, mm-hmm. and very much the paraplegic wheelchair tennis. Which came first? Did you have to be a player first, or were they always in parallel?
To some degree in parallel, but the player part became first because, again, I was not in the world of wheelchair sports yet to know what kind of effort it took to make things happen. I just was a guy in a wheelchair, still relatively newly injured, trying to figure things out, that went to a class and had opportunities to learn about tennis. And so that began, but as I started to figure some more things out, and ultimately, as far as the racket in my hand, the thing that made a huge difference for me is that I tried the orthotic device. I tried everything else that everybody had used, and I decided none of them are working for me. So one day I said, you know what, get rid of everything. I'm just going to take the athletic tape and start taping the fingers around the racket handle in a pattern that I can pull them as tight as I want so that that racket won't slip on me, because I was still having troubles with that over time. So I figured out a method and a pattern for my fingers, for my thumb, that I could do that. And now the racket was in there securely, and relatively comfortably over, but over years there were still some adjustments and some tweaks. But then the real thing that was the huge difference maker for me, there was kind of an aha moment. If I take the athletic tape and turn it around so the sticky side is out, once I've secured the racket in my hand, I'm going to retape the pattern with the sticky side of the athletic tape out. So now I had a much better contact between my hand that was taped into a racket and the push rim. And now that racket side, I could push just as well as my non-racket side. So now all the mobility in the world was at my disposal, at least with my level of injury and those types of things. So that was the huge thing that then took me to the next level of saying, not only can I play this and enjoy this, but now I can seriously think about getting competitive in this sport. And that's what motivated me as an athlete to enter my first tournament in 1984. And I was fortunate enough to win my first tournament. It was a small tournament in Fresno.
It's only a few months after you actually first went to Saddleback.
It was the latter part of 83. So it was a period of months. And again, exploration and experimentation and a process. But I got to the point that, all right, now that I can get the racket in my hand comfortably and consistently, now it's about the athleticism and the tennis potential that I may have, and let's pursue that. So I started becoming an athlete first, but I was fortunate living in Southern California, as I mentioned before, the home of wheelchair tennis with the NFWT. I saw through Brad and Wendy and others, Ron at Saddleback College, I saw what they were doing. And one of the things that they did is they did junior wheelchair sports camps for kids with injuries and disabilities. And so after a short time, I went and volunteered. I thought, well, that's pretty cool. I knew and recognized what I felt and experienced because of the kindness and the support and the efforts of others that gave me the opportunities. And I thought, why wouldn't I want to do that? Why wouldn't I want to try to help out and give back a little bit? And so it was shortly after becoming a tennis player, but I was fortunate that I was exposed to both sides, on the court and off the court, the effort that it requires to do better, to be better, and to make a difference, not only, like I say, in my lives, but saw so many people making the difference in the lives of other people that I wanted to be a part of that as well.
I mean, your taping method is, it's almost, I don't know if you've patented it, but it's known as very much your method, isn't it? Is that both the racket holding hand, where you tape the rackets to the hand, and the hand that holds the wheelchair, the wrong way around? Is that both, or is it just the taping of the racket hand that you really pioneered?
It's just the racket hand. Oftentimes in wheelchair tennis, it's referred to as the dominant hand because it holds the racket, does a lot of the work, and then the non-dominant hand is the free hand that is able to push the push rim. There are some individuals that, and it's typically few, but some that might use a glove, some that might have some tape, either for a blister. They have their own personal reasons, but by far and away, the less tape you use, I think, is actually an advantage kind of thing. And it's not unless it's necessary for a reason. And so, yeah, with the method that I kind of came up with, I'm kind of, I guess, honored by the fact that I think a lot of the variations that the players use these days are some iteration of what I did back in the day. But as I mentioned, it was just that aha moment of sticky side out. Now I have great contact, even though I can't use any of the fingers on that hand to grip the push rim, I have enough friction there that it moves quite well. And then with the other hand, had enough hand strength to be able to push the push rim on that side.
So you solved both the problems that you first came across, the gripping and the mobility.
The biggest concerns, the biggest challenges, I figured out a way to get past those. And now it was all about how much I enjoyed playing sports and playing tennis.
Where were you headed to before the car crash? What was your sort of general direction, either academically or career-wise?
I was going to do some service for my church as a missionary was on the horizon, and then it was going to be come back and go to college. I had aspirations. I spent summers in a small rural farming ranching community in Utah. And used to love doing all the things that city kids didn't do, you know, hauling hay and changing sprinklers and herding cows and sheep and camping and fishing and hunting and all of those types of things. And so I kind of fell in love with that rural concept. And I thought, well, maybe I might like to be like a forest ranger or a veterinarian with large animals. And so I thought, all right, I'm going to do my service and then I'm going to go to school. I'll figure that out in a couple of years. And so that was kind of what I was thinking, is that one of those two is what I was interested in at the time.
So you have a background in service, or an ethos in service.
There's been a bit of that, yeah, as part of my life. I've been raised that way, that you know, helping others is a good thing to do, and wanted to do that. And so maybe I had a bit of that in me already, but thought about, as I mentioned, back to the junior wheelchair sports camps, that looked like, okay, that's now an avenue and possibility for me to be able to do something for others.
Did the wheelchair rugby happen at the same time? Did you do that later? How did that happen?
It was a few years afterwards. So as I became more proficient at tennis, as I, you know, through the class and through just practice and training and those types of things, began to elevate my game to a point that I was starting to enjoy relatively frequent success. And I think, in some ways, that what I was trying to do, because I watched Brad and I watched Randy Snow and all of the Hall of Famers in the wheelchair tennis category, I know them all and I've watched them in parts of their careers. And I thought, if they can do that, can I figure out a way to do that? So I was trying to emulate what the paras were doing and thought, why not? If I'm going to be serious as an athlete, that's the upper level. That's the elite level. I'm going to aspire to do that to the best that I can. And so I tried to elevate the level of competition in the quad division, the standard in the quad division, if you will. Not for me personally, but I thought, there's no reason we can't do this. If they're doing what they do, we emulate them the best that we can with whatever physical abilities we have in our upper extremities to try to mimic that and just be the best athletes that we can. And so in doing that, that I guess maybe raised my exposure to, as I was traveling around the country, we hadn't quite gotten international quad division going yet, but that was coming. But as I was traveling around the country and meeting other players, other quad division players, some of them were playing wheelchair rugby already. And so the conversation started, well, why don't you come play rugby? And I thought, well, I really like tennis, but when I talked to him a little bit more about it, the seasons kind of offset each other. So it wasn't that one was interfering with the other. I could play a tennis season and then I could play a rugby season. And once I started playing rugby again, it was fun. I just enjoyed playing sports. I wasn't looking to be the best in the world, but I was driven to be the very best that I could be. And if the outcome was that I was win a tournament or get a higher ranking, then that's great. It was like, I'm just determined to be the best that I can be. And so with rugby, I really appreciated it was a new group of players. It was a team sport compared to.
Do you know much about rugby?
I knew nothing about it. Back in the day, they called it murder ball, and I wasn't introduced to it early on. But as I said, it was tennis first, and then there were some guys at tennis tournaments that said, "Hey, you ought to come try rugby. You know, you're a pretty decent athlete. You know, I think you'd be great for the team, and I think you'd enjoy it." So I got involved, and I really did enjoy it. And I felt the training was different. I felt the team aspect and the individual aspect was different. And I always felt like one benefited the other. And so I was glad that I was able to get involved in the two of them. And because they didn't overlap so much, it allowed me to pursue both of them to a level that, you know, whatever my determination was going to be, I could pursue it as far as possible, and was on a really good club team in Southern California. And we won 3 national championships in a row, and we were quite competitive for a number of years. And that led to my Paralympic opportunity in 2000, Sydney, with Team USA for wheelchair rugby.
Yeah, and you won the gold medal.
We won a gold medal in Australia. An amazing, incredible experience. Again, I often reflect back on laying in that hospital bed and thinking about what is even possible to being on that medal podium and having a gold medal draped around my neck and thinking, I never would have thought this was possible at one point in time in my life, but how grateful I am that I was willing to try and look at me now, kind of thing.
And you thought about that with the medal being draped around your neck?
I did. It's the same thing with the Hall of Fame in tennis. It just brings back your whole career and your memories, and you think about, where was I? How did I get here? What did it take? For me personally, the effort, the dedication, the sacrifice, the discipline, the practice, the training, all of those things. But at the same token, I often reflect on how many people and organizations did what they have done over the years that allowed me the opportunities and experiences that I had to be able to grow, progress, achieve, accomplish, and succeed. They are a huge part of my story, and I try to never forget that as well.
Apart from being inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame, what were your primary tennis achievements that at the moment of triumph allowed you to refer back to lying in the hospital bed after the car crash?
You know, winning that first tournament was like, wow, I went from not knowing how to do this at all to I just won a tournament. How cool is that? And that led to another opportunity. I remember I played the finals in 1984 at the U.S. Open Wheelchair Tennis Championships in Irvine, California, which during my era, that was the tournament. That was the granddaddy. That was our Grand Slam at that time. And I made it to the finals against Greg Thompson, who I mentioned before, and he beat me. He was a better player. He was a smarter player. And I remember not that I was bitterly disappointed by losing, because he deserved to win, but I thought, I think I can beat him. And if I work a little harder and train a little more, I want to feel what it's like to win a U.S. Open Wheelchair Tennis Championships title. So in 1985, I won. I came back and I won that tournament, and I won, I think, all of the other tournaments that I played that year, which was still a handful. They all tried to have a quad division, but there were still few quads playing, and so sometimes there wasn't a quad division, so I would play in the D division or the C division, something like that, to still be able to play. But in the quad division tournaments, I had a good year in 1985.
So when you were presented with the trophy at Irvine in 1985, did you again have that same moment of, this is where I've come in, what, just 4 years?
Yeah. Again, thinking about where I was, thinking about what my mindset was back in the day. And again, look at me now, and grateful again, as I mentioned, to everybody else in the organizations that provided these opportunities, but proud of myself for what I was willing to then do to get to this point. At some point in time, a lot of life is on you, and your decisions and your approach and your philosophy and your efforts kind of thing. And so to be recognized as a champion was pretty special to me, but it did cause me to reflect.
How does winning a tournament compare with the victory you had in getting the International Tennis Federation to recognize quadriplegic tennis as a discipline worthy of its own competitions?
I count them all as special moments in my life, and again, fortunate to be a part of the process. It was an effort that I felt we wanted to have. Again, in the United States, we were fortunate that there was always a quad division considered, but wheelchair tennis really hadn't at that time expanded internationally. So even wheelchair tennis in general was still new to them. And some of the approaches and models of structure were different in other countries than they were in the United States. And some of that, you know, morphed over time and became more integrated to where we had a quad division fully recognized. And it was received with a willingness to consider it, but they weren't ready to say yes to everything right away. So I parallel it a lot with kind of the men's ATP and then the women's WTA and then wheelchair tennis following suit. Not everything happened at the same time in wheelchair tennis. And so it's not that it was right or wrong, that it was good or bad. It was just the reality of the circumstances. But I felt and recognized that unless we make an effort to advocate for ourselves, maybe some of these things will never happen. And so I felt strongly enough that we were trying to do everything the right way as far as raising the standard of the game and the athleticism of the individuals in the quad division. We were trying to grow the game and get more players involved in those types of things, and always felt like we're the very best in the quad division. And in wheelchair tennis, it's men, women, quads. Able-bodied tennis, it's men and women. But wheelchair tennis, We try to be as similar as possible in a lot of ways, but at the same time, there are some differences. And I felt like those differences needed to be recognized and considered. And to see where the quad division is now, I would probably say, again, it wasn't just me by any means kind of thing, but I am just as proud of the efforts that I put into advocating for the quad division and the options and possibilities that now exist as I am for a gold medal in rugby or for titles in wheelchair tennis or to be inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame. It's a collective that they're all part of who I wanted to be, who I tried to be, the example that I wanted to try to be for others that would follow behind.
Most people who achieve great success, like a US Open title, like a gold medal at the Olympics, are very strongly driven, even if they cover that up. Someone like Roger Federer will cover up, but we know the drive is there. All the people I've spoken to about you say he's selfless. And there's almost something here about how can you achieve so much when you are known as someone who is fairly selfless, who puts the whole ahead of his own stuff, especially in an individual sport like tennis? I'm trying to ask the question as respectfully as possible, but you know what I'm saying, that there is that burning desire in athletes, whatever their sport, which either you cover up very well or you don't seem to have.
Well, I promise you, I have as much of a desire to win as anybody else. My determination was always that I'm going to try to be the best player I can be on any given day. I am playing to win, but I fully recognize and understand that nobody wins all the time. And maybe that loss in 1985 gave me a little bit of a perspective when I lost to Greg Thompson in the finals at the U.S. Open Wheelchair Tennis Championships that, okay, you're a good athlete, but you're not the guy, and certainly not the guy yet, and maybe you can be, but you're going to have to work harder and do better. And so I think that gave me a perspective. I also can remember reading the book, The Inner Game of Tennis, and so much of it is to me, it was about trying to be objective and separate the emotional side of what's going on in your brain so that you weren't so angry when you lost and you weren't so comfortable or even overconfident when you won, but you just recognize that it's a process. And if you stick to the process that works for you, the outcomes can be more positive. And at least, at the very least, you've given your best. I lost matches I should have won, and I didn't like that. I won matches that I probably shouldn't have won, and I recognize that. And yet all of those experiences taught me that it's one thing to be a competitor. It's another thing to compete well and have the proper perspective as competition. Whether it's Roger Federer, whether it's David Hall, whether it's Rick Draney, I don't think our desires to win are any less than Roger's, our desire to do that. And it's not about losing graciously or being a good loser, but it's about having the perspective and understanding that if you're going to put yourself out there to compete, you are going to lose, and you'd better be prepared to deal with that. Otherwise, that's going to be a problem the next time you compete, in my opinion.
And as a lesson in life, that's admirable. And I'm sure a lot of people need to take that on board. But I wonder whether it comes at a cost of when you do win something big, whether the success, the satisfaction isn't as great because you are more on the even keel, because the losses aren't as tragic. The successes maybe aren't as euphoric.
I can't imagine feeling any better than I did winning U.S. Open titles and British Open titles. I can't imagine feeling any better than I did winning a gold medal for Team USA. I can't imagine feeling any better than I did as an inductee of the International Tennis Hall of Fame in 2023. So I enjoyed the success, but again, it was back to the process. What did it take to get here? Being proud of yourself is not a bad thing. Becoming arrogant about your accomplishments, I think, is something that sometimes gets in the way of some people. It's the ego side of things. And yes, we all have it. And competition brings that out in various ways, shapes, or forms to some people. I also think back that some of the experiences I went through after my injury in adjusting and adapting and realizing that everything isn't going to go your way. everything isn't going to happen on your timeline. You are not going to be able to do what you want when you want just because you want to. You have to, again, keep things in perspective. And the only thing I can control, like I said, is my attitude and my effort. Can't control what the other guy on the other side of the net does. I can't control the weather, all of those other intangibles that we don't have control. But I control my mind. I control my emotions. I control the level of training and practice and discipline I've put into things. And I was always very proud of the effort that I put in, but still recognized that the best effort in the world wasn't going to guarantee me that I was going to win every time. So I had to be prepared to lose. That's part of the reality of life. And you learn from it. You grow from it. You move forward. What can I adjust? What can I adapt? How can I do things better? And for me, I found a method, a pattern that worked for me and allowed me this success in two different sports. And again, to achieve the things that I did, I'm incredibly proud of that. So I'm not a social media guy and I don't go around telling everybody about it kind of thing, but I'm just as proud of my accomplishments as anybody. And I don't, again, mean to make that sound arrogant, but I knew the highs and I knew the lows and I experienced both of them and they both taught me some valuable lessons.
So that great pride in your own achievements without wishing to be arrogant, how did you handle being inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame?
I still can't believe it. And, you know, last year, the other Hall of Famers that were here supporting Esther and I as we were inducted in 2023, it's just amazing. I'm still starstruck. And I look around and I think, I'm in the same club as all of these athletes that I watched. I mean, once I got started in tennis, I was a tennis fan. So I watched tennis and I watched all of these athletes competing over their careers. And to be amongst them and to be around them is just something so incredibly special that I just don't know there are words to describe what it means to be a part of that group. And at the same time, it was interesting. I was actually observing some of them and, you know, Chris Evert's here and they've renamed the Learning Center, the Chris Evert Learning Center, and what a huge honor. And so Martina and Tracy and Rosie and others here to support her. And then Andre Agassi was here. And, you know, they're big names. People, everybody knows them in the tennis
sure world, are.
Along with all of the others that are here. But I just observed them. And you know, everybody wants to get a picture. Everybody wants an autograph and shake their hand. And it's amazing to think that I'm part of that group. At the same time, I'm almost kind of glad that I don't have that same level of notoriety because I so respect and appreciate their kindness and their time. Imagine everywhere you go, somebody always wanting to get some of your time kind of thing. What a challenge that is. So I get to be a part of things, but I don't have to deal with some of the things that they have to deal with. So to me, I'm kind of in a really great sweet spot.
Well, it's lovely. When I heard your acceptance speech, you thanked a few people, which is great and totally natural. And then you spent an awful lot of time explaining how in awe you were of Esther Vahir, who was being inducted with you. Now, understandable given Esther's achievements, all the matches she won, but isn't there also an element of you deserve to be here?
I recognize that, and I appreciate that, and I embrace that, and I am so honored. I mean, I can, every one of them, Brad and Randy from the U.S., and Esther and Monique and Chantal from the Netherlands, and David Hall from Australia, and now Rick Draney, again, from the United States, but the first ever quad division wheelchair tennis player in the whole world to be inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame. It blows my mind. I can tell you stories about all of those other six individuals because I watched them. When I wasn't playing, I said, I want to be more like him. I want to be more like her. Look at the way he hits his forehand or she hits her backhand or the way he moves or she moves or what they do. So to be counted among them is a huge honor for me. But I fully embrace the fact that I am very proud of my career and all that I have accomplished, but I see others doing the same thing. So it's really more of a celebration of all of us together. And I'm lucky enough to be a part of that small crew. But as I've said before, it was a lot of people, family, friends, individuals, organizations that did what they did that allowed me to be the one to have my name and picture on a plaque in the Hall of Fame.
I take it you get invited to give talks to groups. What's the message you most like giving out? What do you like them to come away with?
There are two things that oftentimes I will talk about, a few things. Often it will be initially the message is that life is not fair, it's not fun, and it's not always easy. But that's the way life is for everybody. You can always look around and find somebody worse off than you. You can always look around and find somebody better off than you. So your circumstances are your circumstances. And so now the issue, as I said before, is it's not about what happens to you, but it's how you choose to deal with it. So what are the choices you're going to make to figure out how to deal with it, to figure out how to overcome, to figure out how to move, whatever the case may be. Sometimes I will talk about three E's, about you've got to be willing to make the effort. Effort brings results to varying degrees at varying times, but without effort, nothing's going to happen. It's also about embracing whatever that experience is. And again, I loved to compete. I loved to win. I was okay with losing because I knew it was a part of it. But it was just the idea that I have the opportunity to test myself against somebody else or as a teammate with another team kind of thing. So embracing the challenge, not backing away from it or not saying, no, I am so grateful that I didn't give up on trying tennis when I was out on that court for the first time with my friend. Think of where, you know, things may have gone from there. Who knows? But I'm grateful that I was willing to embrace that challenge and try to move forward.
So effort. Embrace. What's embrace. The third E?
And the third one is to enjoy the experience. Again, I've been so many places and met so many people and have so many wonderful memories. I'm not a statistics guy. I can't tell you my overall win-loss record. I can't tell you total number of titles in all the tournaments and in all of the years. I can't tell you right now how many weeks at number one in singles or doubles or anything like that. But I can tell you about people that have made an impact in my life, and I can tell you about the experiences that I had that made the memories that much better. So when I was out there receiving a trophy, looking around and thinking about everybody that made this possible for me. So that's one thing I do. Some other times I'll talk about ACE, ACET, attitude, choice, and effort. So again, it's not about what happens, it's the attitude. It's about the choices you make. What are you going to do with your circumstances? Are they going to deal with you, or are you going to deal with them? And then again, it comes back to the effort at the end. Are you willing to make the effort to figure out what's possible for yourself?
You're a campaigner as well as an athlete. What still needs to be done in wheelchair tennis, or particularly quad wheelchair tennis?
It is such an amazing time in wheelchair tennis these days. And back in my day, I thought it was. I mean, again, we were not in the Paralympics. As early as 1992, I was advocating for Paralympics to have a quad division. It finally happened in 2004. And so since 2004, that's been going on. And that was towards the tail end of my career. Part of the reason I have a gold medal in wheelchair rugby is because there was not wheelchair tennis for the quad division. I thought, if I'm going to get to the Paralympics, maybe rugby's my option. So I pursued that seriously leading up to 2000, qualified for the team. In 2004, as it was coming up, I was competing, training, and I was starting to age out, and I wasn't sure if I was going to be seriously competitive as a singles player. But David Wagner, another American, and I had been playing doubles together, and I felt very confident about our potential as a doubles team. A few months, it was down in Australia, I ruptured a tendon in my right wrist. So I missed out on several key tournaments and ranking points in the months leading up to the cutoff date for qualifying for Paralympics, and I missed out by a few points. So disappointed, yes, but at the same time, recognizing that, hey, it's finally in there. And so I'm going to take some pride in thinking that maybe I had a part in that. And then by 2008, I had pretty much aged out, and it just wasn't much of a reality to be competitive at that time. But to see now it's there. We have an ITF world champion in the quad division along with the men and the women. We have quad division in all four of the Grand Slams and all of the big tournaments around the United States. with the USTA, the things that they're doing these days are incredible. Full integration across the spectrum. It's not its own dedicated wheelchair tennis department, but it's just a part of everything that everybody does at the USTA. We have a junior pathway, and collegiate programs are bigger now than they've ever been. We have juniors from around the world that are actually now being recruited to come and study in the United States and get a scholarship to play wheelchair tennis. We have the player development at the USTA with the elite level U.S. players and training there full time and having all of the resources available to them as they pursue their professional career. The prize money is much better than it was. Players, the elite players, the top players are actually making a living at doing what they're doing. The collegiate space is growing and doing incredible things with the Intercollegiate Tennis Association and with the NCAA here in the United States. But again, all of these things are taking place not only here, other countries as well. They have full-blown wheelchair tennis programs and full-time coaches and administrators and all of the support. To see the level of the technology in the chairs and the design, the equipment, to see that these players now have access to the training and the funding and the full team concept of, you know, if I need the nutritionist and I need the mental skills coach, whatever it is, those resources are available. I mean, I went to Saddleback College, but a lot of what I did, I was figuring out on my own. It wasn't until a little bit later in my career that I had some coaches and had some habits by then that were a little difficult to overcome and break. And Jason and Butch and they would try to help me with those things. But now to see everything that's available, Paralympics, the World Team Cup, which is our equivalent to, you know, Davis Cup and BJK Cup, really everything that's going on in the able-bodied tennis world is happening in the wheelchair tennis world.
Which brings me on to the final thing I want to cover with you, which is what can the able-bodied world do? Because I suppose this is across the whole of life. Able-bodied people are very grateful for the fact that they have their all their faculties. They are greatly admiring of what wheelchair people do, but there's not always an understanding. What can the able-bodied community do to respect, without being patronizing, of wheelchair tennis and other wheelchair sports?
It's a process. I mean, more of the Hall of Famers, more of the pro players that are on the ATP and WTA tours are seeing the wheelchair tennis players because, as we said before, they're now at the Grand Slams. They're at some ATP events. They're doing some things with some WTA events. So that integration, so to speak, is helping to bridge that gap, if you will, of understanding and of knowledge and of realizing that we're all tennis players, standing up or sitting down. We're here to compete. We're here to try to win, but we're athletes. We're serious about our craft, about our sport, and we're here to do that. And so I think there's been an elevated level of respect just because of the integration that's taken place. The world is different now than it was 30 and 40 years. And you know, there is, again, there are more opportunities, sports and recreational. You have more coverage of Paralympics on television than you ever had before, and more being written about Paralympics and Paralympic athletes. And so,
that's some great stories.
They are incredible athletes. There's the backstory. Like, we all have a backstory, whoever it is. But then the incredible stories about who they are as athletes and what they've accomplished and what they're striving to accomplish, just like all the Olympic athletes are doing the same thing. So it's a process. And again, like a lot of things, it doesn't always follow the same trajectory or the same timeline. But it's, again, things are so much better than they were many, many years ago. For me at the Hall of Fame, here I am again, standing with all these other greats and legends in the game. And I'm just one of the group. I'm Rick Draney, and that's Andre Agassi, and that's Chris Everett, and on down the line, Stan Smith, and those. Things have improved. The opportunities, the experiences, the exposure, integrative opportunities, particularly in tennis. All of these commentators and broadcasters, they know that there's wheelchair tennis. They mention them and talk about them, and they're included in the trophy ceremonies. I was on Stadium Court, Arthur Ashe Stadium Court, at Billie Jean King National Tennis Center last year, receiving my Hall of Fame ring from Stan Smith. I mean, that's integration. That's They just were celebrating Esther, celebrating me, like they would celebrate any other champion and Hall of Famer.
And should able-bodied tennis players try wheelchair tennis? Should there be more opportunities, or does that slightly denigrate it?
There's actually, I think, an interesting dynamic that takes place when somebody tries something that they probably can't understand unless they try it. And in the case of wheelchair tennis, yes, it's one thing to be a tennis player, standing up or sitting down. But until you experience, and this is a kind of a great side story, Jason Harnett at the USTA, they had a camp for elite level juniors, and they brought in some of the elite level wheelchair tennis juniors and said, let's do a camp together at the same time. It made a huge impression on the able-bodied juniors to get in a chair, to try some drills, and to, number one, recognize that, you know, we got to respect you for what you do because I can't do this kind of thing. This is difficult. Man, I respect you. But number two, they just understand that even though we're different in some ways, all people are more alike than we are different. And so the similarity in this instance is tennis. So the wheelchair part disappears, and now we're all just juniors, and we're all tennis players, and we're hanging out. And so now when they see each other at the Grand Slams, because juniors are now a part of the Grand Slams, not all of them yet, but that's coming very quickly. So some of these kids that saw each other at the USTA National Campus are now seeing each other at these Grand Slam events, like, hey, you know, and they're just friends. They're just tennis friends. And it's awesome to see that. So I think having the opportunity to try it out, it gives you that perspective, it gives you that appreciation and even that respect, but it also connects you even more because you realize that once we look past that, we're just tennis players.
Rick Draney, thank you very much indeed, not just for this interview, but for everything you've done for wheelchair tennis.
Thank you very much. It's been an honor to be with you today.
And that was the inspiring Hall of Famer Rick Draney in conversation with Chris Bowers. And I hope you feel enriched by listening to Rick. The wheelchair tennis players deserve every drop of respect they get from the wider tennis community. If you'd like to hear more from the top of the wheelchair tennis world, Blair Henley's interview with the remarkable Dutch champion Esther Vergeer is one of the many interviews you can find in the Tennis Worthy archives. That's a great listen, too. And by the way, Esther gave one of the greatest induction speeches I've ever heard. I'm Patrick McEnroe. Join us again for more tennis-worthy content from the International Tennis Hall of Fame. So long for now.